Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Perfect. So it's wonderful to be here in the truly lovely Mosaic Rooms and to have everybody here. Thank you so much for coming. It's just a special privilege to be able to present my collection, The Hidden Light of Objects, here and to be in conversation with the wonderful Selma Dabah. I'm really excited. A warm thank you to Omar Al-Katan for the invitation and to Rachel and Angelina for arranging tonight's event. I have to thank Talia Suzuma, who's from Bloomsbury Qatar Foundation, who's been an incredible support over the course of the launch of my book, and to so many faces here from Bloomsbury, past and present, who have been an incredible support to me through the process. So thank you, everybody. I thought I'd begin by telling you a little bit about myself. I was born in Kuwait, but was only a few months old when my parents moved to London, and then Edinburgh, and then St. Louis, Missouri. Like many of their generation, my parents studied abroad with the aim of returning back to contribute to the development of their young nation state. I spent the first 6 years of my life mainly in the U.S., which meant that my first language was English. Once back in Kuwait, this didn't change as much as you might think. My parents enrolled me in the American School of Kuwait. At the time, this was quite rare for girls whose parents were both Kuwaiti. I have my mother to thank for that. So despite the fact that I grew up mainly in Kuwait, English was and remains my first language, indeed my mother tongue. I don't remember a time in my life without literature, without stories, reading, and writing. My grandfather, my mother's father, studied English literature in India during the colonial period. He read voraciously, everything from canonical texts to eccentric books on numerology. And he passed his love of reading on to my mother, who also studied English literature, whose first language, like mine, was also English. My earliest memories are of my mother's voice reading to me from Mother Goose. My mother passed her love and her father's love of books along to me. And like both of them, I too studied English literature and now teach it at Kuwait University. But it wasn't until I completed my degrees and started teaching that I felt I could turn to writing fiction myself. It took me a while to figure out that writing fiction feels most like home. When I first started writing the 10 stories that would make up this collection, I didn't know that they would belong together in one book. It wasn't until the third or fourth story that I began to notice certain words, images, characters, and ideas recurring. The stories in The Hidden Light of Objects are loosely connected, held together by these repetitions and by a series of short vignettes narrated in the first person that precede each story. I think of the vignettes as an invisible wire holding the stories together, or more organically as their connective tissue. The stories are set mainly in the Middle East, in Kuwait, Palestine, Lebanon, but also outside the Middle East, in Greece, Japan, and the United States. The stories don't deal overtly with the complicated geopolitics of our region. They emphasize instead the everyday lives of the people who live there. Obvious from the title, the trope of objects and their secret lives play a key role in the stories. The idea that objects have hidden lives is something most children understand only too well. As adults, however, we tend to forget about the magic quality objects held for us as kids. But when you find a forgotten bear or pouch of marbles or an old notebook, and you hold the object in your hands after many years have passed, something of that sensation returns. One of the questions these stories seek to uncover is, why does this sensation matter? It isn't just about recollecting the past, although I think that's a part of it. And it isn't about nostalgia either, although I have to consciously stop myself from being sucked into nostalgia's quicksand trap. The hidden light of our special objects reminds us of something we once understood or a way of life we once thought might be possible. It reminds us of alternatives. This realization can be disturbing. It can shake us out of our current complacency. The intimate objects that share our lives can play an indispensable role in revealing all this to us. My stories explore this special capacity of objects to expose hidden light. So I thought I'd read a short excerpt from the title story of the collection. The Hidden Light of Objects is about a Kuwaiti woman, Zaina, abducted from Kuwait in 1991 in the crazy days just after liberation and held captive in Iraq for a decade. The story is narrated back and forth by Zaina and her oldest daughter, Jinan, both trying to make sense of Zaina's 10-year absence and her sudden release. The section I'm going to read, which occurs about two-thirds of the way through the story, begins with the daughter, Jinan, reflecting on the dramatic changes to Kuwait post-liberation and how these were intertwined with her family's specific tragedy of losing Zaina. This is followed by Zaina, her mother, reflecting on how, in the early days of her abduction, she figured out a way to use the memory of her beloved objects to keep herself alive. So, all right, so this is the voice of the daughter first, Jinan. There is no going back. I should have realized this after the occupation, the so-called liberation. Nothing, not a thing, went back to the way it had been. New people in the country, new food, new habits, new language. Suddenly, women swathed in ominous black hoods. One year can blot out the past, everything that we were before, twinkling water, pure desert, and life is channeled into a bucket of mud. No going back. The filth and dirt everywhere, the corruption, the sooted skies, and murky seas. Nobody seemed to care, everyone swallowing fistfuls of dollars as fast as they could. We were suspended, watching it all through sandblasted glass, thinking everything was different because she had been taken from us, making it personal. But it wasn't just her absence, this new and sadly rotting Kuwait. She would have known how to deal with it, we told ourselves, how to make life work despite the doomed tangle. We were, for 10 years, in a situation that was unheimlich. We no longer belonged. All we could do was look back and pine for what could never again exist. Our lives before were padded by her presence. There are people who know how to make life safe despite the deepest sorrows. With a matchbox and Kleenex, my mother would fashion baby ghost dolls in a tiny bed for us to play with. And when she and my father had some money, working like demons in their 20s, the early successes of our precious little boomtown, she spent it on travel, on buying beautiful things, on her garden, her house, because she knew it could all disappear, that now was the time to enjoy it. The thing is to be light as air, she would say. Our lives before were as light as air. We were lucky, luck of the draw. The lucky are hated the world over, detested, and rightly so. The lucky make it worse for everyone else. But we have paid our dues, so has she, and she didn't deserve it. And now I switch to the voice of the mother. In the trunk of that still Mercedes, when I believed I would be dead in seconds, thoughts of my girls filled me. It felt like being lit from the inside, and the fear of death, though undeniably there, diminished. They go on, I go on. Once it became clear none of us was going to be killed, the small number of Kuwaiti POWs kept alive were apparently valuable bargaining chips in the endless negotiation for reduced sanctions or increased loans, I knew something had to change. I could not keep filling myself with their light, my children's or even my husband's, because it made me want to go home, heimlich. And as we came to realize after that first year in captivity, there was no chance we were going home anytime soon. It wasn't that I stopped thinking about them completely. That would have been impossible. But what allowed me to create a new kind of home for myself out of the infuriating suspension we now inhabited, a limbo punctuated by the violence and disregard of men whose poverty and desperation could be seen in their bloodshot eyes and crusty yellow nails, was shifting focus from the life I knew to the objects I had once owned. Between my body and me, between the ones I loved and me, a cavalcade of possessions. I can't expect them to understand any of that yet. How the things that belonged to me, fine lace pieces from Burano, clumps of silver jewelry from Peshawar, my youngest daughter's old blanket, red clay pots from Lebanon, my father's dusty books from India, a little packet of playing cards wrapped in the brightest fuchsia tissue paper, which I could never bring myself to unwrap, my mother's string of delicate pearls floating in gold, her gift to me before she died, each in their way embalmed the kernels of my life. Stop there.
Thank you very much, May. Thank you, everyone. Can you hear me? Everyone hear me in the back? Thank you very much, BQFP, for asking me to come here today and for introducing me to this collection, which has been, I really need to congratulate May further because it's a very ambitious collection of short stories, both in terms of the style that it adopts and the range of voices that you hear within it. It's also got this very unique feature of having been interspersed, of having stories combined with these very personal vignettes in between the stories that work beautifully and tie together the common themes. So I already the book has received praise from Hanan al-Sheikh, from the Sydney Morning Herald, and it's been praised for its poetic qualities and its range. How are you feeling now that you've got the book out? How does it feel? I've been in your place 3 years ago. I know it's quite a sort of a rush of excitement and bewilderment. But
It is. I mean, it's been a really tremendous experience, and what you feel is very unexpected in many ways. I mean, the book was launched in Kuwait first, or actually in Doha, Qatar first, and then Kuwait, and we did a number of different events in Kuwait, and the response to the book there and in the region has been quite positive, and that was very heartening to see that there was a readership out there that was interested in the book. So that's been fantastic. For me, it's a very strange experience in some ways. It's not exactly what I felt, because in some ways the book now feels disconnected from me. So it doesn't feel like, you know, yay, now it's out there. It actually feels like it's no longer mine.
No, so it goes on its own journey.
It has its own journey, completely different. So yeah. It's not exactly what I expected, the experience of having it published. It's lovely that people have nice things to say about it, and that's very encouraging. But at the same time, it almost feels like they're saying it about something that is disconnected from me personally. So, yeah, it's been interesting.
You've talked a little bit about the process of writing the book and putting the collection together, but I was just wondering if you could talk, because, you know, I'm quite similar to you in terms of coming to writing a little bit later in life, and I think that if you come from a place or a nationality which sometimes seems a little bit peripheral from the literary centres which are of the English-speaking world, and if you're a woman as well, there's a lot of reasons why you feel that you shouldn't perhaps be writing or dealing with the subjects which are very familiar to you, that they aren't as perhaps as important on the global stage or as literary, or as worthy of literary notice. And I think it takes a long time to maybe to gather the confidence to not just critique and read and absorb in a passive way, but to say, I'm actually now going to step out and create, make my mark. And I was wondering whether there were specific writers that you read who inspired you, individuals in your life. Some of them seem to come up in the book,
Yes. Possibly
disguised or based on people who have brought you to a position of saying that this is what I want to do.
So it's really strange. writing was always a part of my life. I've been writing since I was 8. In fact, I don't remember a time where I wasn't writing in some way. And yet, bizarrely, it never occurred, and reading, I should say, you know, the books, and we can talk about the books that were important to me, but reading voraciously, you know, this idea that I pick up a book in a place like Kuwait and I enter a world that I would never otherwise have had access to. I mean, I found that to be just remarkable, you know, the capacity of literature to do that. And yet, it never occurred to me that I should write, you know, that I could, you know, I could do the same thing if I wanted to. You know, I could write a story or I could write fiction. And I did start writing. I mainly kept journals, and I'd write poetry, and I'm so grateful that none of that poetry had ever been published. You know, but then I after I went to university, I went into a literary career. So I studied literature at university and went on and got my PhD. And that academic life took over, although it was still involved, you know, still completely involved and immersed in literature and writing. It was a completely different kind of writing. And so I've continued to write, but I'm doing academic work, literary criticism, all of that kind of thing. And that ate into my time and into my life for so long. And it was after I started teaching at Kuwait University where it suddenly sort of hit me that I can also write fiction. You know, I can turn to fiction. And I turned to fiction specifically because of the way things were going in the region post 9/11, and also because I came back to Kuwait after a long time away, and it was no longer the Kuwait that I had known or grown up with or was familiar with. And I look around me, and it seemed like everybody had fallen into a kind of state of amnesia because nobody else seemed to remember the Kuwait that I had grown up with, which was much more open, more heterogeneous, more cosmopolitan. And it felt incredibly stifling and claustrophobic. And no matter what kind of academic work I was doing, and I write about cultural politics in the region in my academic work, it just didn't seem sufficient. Mm-hmm. And fiction became a way for me to open a space to kind of remind myself first. So I wasn't really thinking about audience, but just remind myself first that a different kind of place existed and that there is the possibility for this alternative place to kind of reemerge in the future. And only so the kind of things that fiction had done for me growing up as a kid was kind of what I wanted fiction to do for me now, only I was writing it. And so that's why I turned, and I did come to it late. And I do have some regrets about coming to writing fiction late. On the other hand, I think that the sort of detour that I took through academe may have turned me into a better or maybe more confident writer. So I think maybe no regrets are better. Better not to have regrets.
Well, actually, to talk about regrets, it was something I very strongly felt in the book, was that there was a lot of looking back. But this expression that you had about nostalgia, you were saying you were trying to sort of avoid falling into it. I mean, you felt that it was actually more of a celebration of the past and a rejoicing of something rather than a kind of looking back. I felt very few regrets there. It was something very much embraced, and I felt... And actually, it was quite strange for me because I have a very different recollection of Kuwait, a different sort of experience of it. But maybe, but it seemed to be filled with warmth and history and family and a closeness and an excitement, you know. And I found it also extraordinary to read about some of the parties that were going on in Kuwait at the time in the 80s. And I've heard other people say, I've traveled all around the world since Kuwait, but I've never had parties as good as the ones in Kuwait in the 80s.
That was
we had very
true.
Good parties,
yes,
and it's
absolutely.
Sort of something that people didn't really
yes,
expect.
Absolutely, that's true.
And they were all quite prohibited, yes. Increasingly so, which
yes.
made them more exciting.
Yes. it's very true.
We were May and I were in two schools, both May was in the American school, I was in the English school, we were born in the same year, so it was this something when I was reading her book, I find it quite curious, because we were both in these international schools, which really were, you know, they were filled with Arabs, but we were not really allowed to connect with being Arab. We were sort of being... kind of the world that we were being taught about through English or American teachers was very outward-looking.
Yeah.
So we were in a kind of a particular bubble.
A particular bubble. Yes.
It was a bubble within a very closed world, and yes. It was a very small place.
Yes.
I mean, I always used to find that the peer groups were quite tight,
yes.
In terms of how one experienced it socially. And how did you feel going back to that world and talking about things like parties and boys and falling in love? I mean, how has that gone down with your parents in Kuwait?
Oh, no. My parents are totally fine with it, you know. But what was interesting for me is that, yes, in some ways it was a bubble, you know, that the international schools and the kids in the international schools got to experience a different kind of social life than perhaps those who went to government schools may have, more conservative families and so on. And yet, at the same time, I feel that the generation of my parents and even my grandparents, it was much more open than what I'm seeing is being experienced by my students at university today. So again, it was baffling for me, you know, to come in with magazines from Kuwait from the 1950s and 60s, and show it to my students. And you know, you've got young girls in mini skirts, and you know, their cute little hairdos, and all of this. And I show it to my students, and that they can't believe that this was Kuwait, or that this was the life that their parents or their grandparents at this point were experiencing. And these are, you know, Kuwaitis that didn't necessarily go to the international schools, because very few Kuwaitis, especially Kuwaiti girls, went to international schools at that time. That was quite rare. Now it's very, very common. Although, paradoxically, it's common, and yet there's a different, I think in some ways the texture of the social life of these young kids is a bit more insular and more closed than the one that we experienced, which was much more overlapping. So at these parties, you would have international kids, but you would also have sort of kids from government schools,
yeah.
Coming in, and you had this kind of multiplicity and a kind of cosmopolitanism that I found particularly attractive, and the texture of it was really interesting to me growing up in that. And that's what I felt was missing. And so looking back, I mean, I had to stop myself. I think that, you know, I do plunge into nostalgia a little bit, but I find, I mean, nostalgia can be a real problem if you use it and in a way that kind of hooks you into the past without any connection to the present or to any thinking about the future. That wasn't really what I was hoping for. My sense was I wanted to look back at this moment that I did see as a kind of bubble, and maybe I'm looking back at it with, looking at it as a kind of golden moment. But at the same time, I think it was urgent to present that to a younger generation growing up today that don't see that at all. You know, that they can't believe that it existed. And we talk about those parties, they don't necessarily believe that it could be true. You know, that, I mean, they're still happening, those great parties. They're still there, but not quite in the same way. And it's in some ways, Kuwait was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody almost, it felt like almost everybody knew everybody else. That doesn't exist at all, I feel, anymore. You have groups, but you don't have that overlap. And I do miss that, I have to say.
but with your own sort of personal accounts, we were talking briefly about this earlier. I was just wondering, how do you feel when people ask you about autobiographical content in your stories? Because it's something I find very stultifying. I find it a little bit constricting as a writer,
yes.
Because you feel that every time you're going to have a character, their actions, their emotions are identified with being yours, then you'll become a lot more cagey about what you,
yes.
How you want to present them, and you want to create that distance. I think one of the reasons I had a male character as one of my main characters was because I felt that they'd be less likely to see it as being me, you know,
yeah.
Even.
Yeah.
So how did you get the balance? Because there's obviously I hate to put it back to you, the question which I said I don't like, but there's a fair bit in the book which draws on, your own experience
yeah.
of that time. How do you feel that that's something you needed to do for your short collection, and that your novel, for example, goes into a more fictive feel, that this was just a kind of a more meditative... Well, actually, you've got a really interesting balance between very meditative, subjective, contemplative stories and kind of broader story you know, storyteller stories, yeah, with a strong narrative and a, you know, a canvas with characters.
That sure,
were,
yeah.
A much broader
different
range.
Places
so
as well.
It's quite varied in that respect.
I think, so because some of the characters are female, a certain age, and set in Kuwait, and so am I. I'm from Kuwait. You can, you know, you may easily, or a reader may easily decide to collapse me with, mm-hmm, or the writer with the characters. But, I mean, of course we carry traces of who we are and our experiences when we write. I mean, that's what I think what makes any writer's text singular, and it makes it their own. It doesn't, I think that, you know, looking at texts, especially texts that are fiction, so I'm not writing autobiography, I see myself as writing fiction. Even if those texts have autobiographical traces or personal elements or carry some of the experiences of the writer, I think it's really limiting to look at a fictional text as autobiography because it means that the referent is only the writer rather than, you know, opening up, fiction can open up the possibility of the reader experiencing all kinds of different things. Whereas, you know, to reduce it only to the writer is unfortunate. I think it really limits. I think that there is a tendency in the Middle East to read texts a little bit in that way, yeah, that you conflate the writer with the story. So, sure, you know, there are things that people who know me may recognize certain things or certain characters or certain events that were familiar, and that's fine. But I think that, you know, other readers who may know nothing at all about me can still, you know, get something out of the text without having to make that link. So, I think that, you know, fiction can do more exciting things for me than autobiography. And I also think, yeah, there is a, in some ways, I feel like I do kind of have to get some of that stuff out there. And the novel that I'm working on will have certain things that might be familiar to people who know me, but on the other hand, it will stand as a work of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more interesting to see it that way.
Sure. It's really interesting what you say about how people read books in the Arab world, because I have also found, not just with the identification with autobiography, but with the idea that the story is not a story with many nuances and a world that you sort of dive into and live for the duration of the fictive work, but it's something with a message. And the character represents X, you know, so if you have a character who dies, that character is Palestine, and you're saying nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really miserable end, you know.
Yeah.
And I found that because I've had feedback like that sometimes, I've often, you know, when you're writing, you're thinking, oh my God, is somebody going to think that this is this? And they have to really push it aside say, actually, sorry, I can't cater to that because I'll just get, you know, into complete mess because I'm not writing in symbols.
Yes.
But it's partly the way that, you know, literature is taught, which can be quite, I'm sure you're completely different. I mean, some of the students I met in Gaza, it seems very didactic. It's like this is the story and this is the interpretation.
Yeah.
They go and Google other interpretations or find out their own ideas and then be told they were wrong. They get very low marks.
It has to be that way.
Strict vision of
that is very true. There is this tendency. And I don't think it's only limited, actually not only limited to the Middle East, because I mean, there is, I think, a tendency to read quote-unquote third-world texts as political allegories, you know, or national allegories. I mean, Frederick Jameson wrote the essay on that, you know, all third-world literature is political allegory, national allegory. And, of course, if you want to read the text that way, you surely can, you know, if you're going to look for symbols and you're going to try to find. But I think that, again, that like reading it as autobiography, reading it only as political allegory or as national allegory is really limiting and restricting, because the text can do so much more than that. I mean, sometimes it can be read as a personal story. Sometimes it can be read in relation to events that are going on at the moment or historical or whatever it happens to be that you're interested in. The text can kind of open up to that multiplicity if you let it. But I do think in the Middle East also, you're absolutely right that there is, you know, there's a right and wrong way to read, and that I think maybe perhaps some writers kind of have used this technique of the allegory, and so readers are kind of accustomed to doing that. I think that's really true.
Mm-hmm. And Would you like to say a couple more words about the structure of the collection and the use of vignettes
Sure.
within it? Because it's quite unusual. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the book so far. It's a collection of stories with these very short pieces, maybe a page or so, which are almost sometimes quite like notes. Sometimes it's just a moment or a fraction.
Yes.
Sometimes
yeah.
very deeply dwelled into. Sometimes almost like something torn out of a diary. And then they sometimes connect directly to the story
yes.
afterwards with a thread. Sometimes I haven't been able to catch
That's right.
quite,
That's true.
What the thread is between
That's,
that the story which
and the
comes
next.
Afterwards.
That's so. Very true. I mean, some of them are clearly linked to the mm-hmm. stories that follow. So each of the 10 stories is preceded by a short vignette that's narrated in the first person by a character who recurs in a number of the stories called Mina. And so she's narrating, and she's kind of looking back at a particular moment in Kuwait as an adult, looking back at this time in the 80s when she was an adolescent growing up. And so the way that I wrote the collection, when I first started writing the stories, I didn't really have a sense that they were going to come together as a collection. I thought I was writing separate stories. But by the third or fourth, I began, as I said in the intro, just to notice certain things that were recurring in a really interesting way. And then characters started reappearing and, you know, these words and images. I mean, in one of the stories, and I don't know if I should tell you because maybe you'll read it, but in one of the stories, so in Bear, I'll just tell you. So in Bear, there's a mention of a picture, a phantom photograph. And I wasn't, you know, I didn't really understand what it was. And I included, and that was one of the earlier stories that I wrote. And at the very end of the collection, the very last story, that photograph recurs. And so there were these strange things that were happening as I was writing the stories where it really began to make sense to me that they were, in fact, they were resonating and they were linked in these very interesting ways. And then the vignettes I wrote together, all in one go, thinking that maybe they would appear in the middle or at the very end. But then I thought it was too much to ask of the reader to make the connections, you know, that you link the stories together, so you link the vignettes to the... So I did the work for them, basically. And the vignettes are... Some of them are very tangentially linked to the story that comes after. Sometimes it's just a word mm-hmm. that appears in the vignette that connects it to something in the story that follows. Other times, like you said, it was more substantial. And again, a vignette is a kind of window. And I felt that the vignettes were, again, opening a little bit of a different kind of window, a different slant to the story that came after, but also to the other stories in the collection. I mean, each of the stories is autonomous. It stands on its own. You can read the short story by itself. But I did think about the way that the collection was organized. I did want it to be in this particular order, and the vignettes kind of made sense to me in relation to each of the stories as well. And so I think that they all work together and they resonate together in the order that I had them. But you can do whatever you want. You don't have to read the vignettes with the stories.
Would you like to read one?
Sure, let me, yeah.
To give an example.
So this is the vignette. It comes before a story called Her Straw Hat. And I don't think it needs much of an introduction. The character Mina and Sara are friends, and there's a character mentioned at the end, and he's a recurring character, so he comes up again in some of the vignettes and some of the stories. So, Sara once gave me a tiny gold ring with a speck of emerald on it. It may have been for my birthday. It may have been for friendship. It fit just barely around my ring finger. Sara had hair like a Brillo pad. At least that's what Jake and Andrew said. Every single day, twice a day, for about 2 years. We weren't sure what a Brillo pad was, what exactly it looked like, but we knew it wasn't good, that it implied something harsh and kinked, something to scour black pans with, a cruel exaggeration of Sara's hair. They called her Brillo Pad and me Mona Lisa, which sounds a lot better, but wasn't. Yellow-eyed Jake and red, flaky Andrew, cherry orange hair, pale pink freckled skin, you know the type, horrible, diseased looking, but saved, swelled and made cocky by his Americanness. Not much we could say to counter that. When Sarah and I were younger, Jake and Andrew ignored us. But by the time we were around 11 or 12, we were worth poking and prying. For them, we were an untapped version of fun. We weren't mice, Sarah and I. We would poke and pry back, mocking yellow eyes and splotchy red skin. But with a single, "Oh yeah, Brillo pad," or a solitary, "What you looking at, Mona Lisa?" we were screwed in our places. Sarah was self-conscious about her thorny hair, and I was unsettled by being likened to Mona Lisa, who I had read might actually be a man, and who, in any case, had a sneaky smile. For a year or two, we put up with their unpleasantness. Girls change suddenly. At 14 or 15, they can become minxes without notice. After one long summer, Sarah marched onto the bus wearing the kind of lush beauty, red-lipped, olive-skinned, that makes cars honk and boys and girls gasp. I boarded after Sarah, all high cheekbones and newly angled arms, and Jake and Andrew, slack-jawed, fell over themselves trying to blot out years of teasing and to replace it as quickly as possible with a new, awkward fawning. Sarah and I, blotting out what we could of Jake and Andrew, so much smaller than we remembered them, talked with striking animation about the weather. At the end of the year that we morphed into minxes, I exchanged Sarah's ring for a small leather pouch. The ring was the only thing I had on me that I cared about, the only thing I could give to Jonas that last day. Sarah was not happy and considered my gesture thoughtless, frivolous. What Sarah never really understood was that giving away my emerald ring said more about my love for her, black-haired beauty, than my love for him.
Thank you very much for the reading. A further question just on the writing in the collection which deals with subjects of political subject matter. Where have you stood on this? I mean, it's something which is expected often of writers from the Arab world. I mean, I know it's definitely, I always say with writers from Palestine, it's like it's almost a complete, you subvert the assumption, you know, with literature in the West, it's that it's not political, yeah. With Palestinian literature, that it must be. Mm. I mean, Kuwait has a very different and a conflicted, changing political role, mm. which is partly shown in the character of Amrika in your story, is this sort of relationship with the West. Yeah. And I would expect also a relationship with the past, with the pre-Gulf War era, which led to many considerable changes in the country. So how do you bring it into your work, and when, and how do you decide which events you cover? Because there were some that I experienced in Kuwait that I didn't see, which was very forefront in my mind, like the 83 bombings. But then there were other ones which I was maybe less aware of.
So you're absolutely right that there is an expectation that any writer from the Middle East has to write about politics. But I mean, I really think that almost any book, even a kind of romance novel, it's political in a sense, in the decision not to write about politics is a political decision. So I think when I started writing the stories, like I had said, one of the reasons that I really wanted to do it was because I felt everything was closing in and it felt so claustrophobic. I needed to open up a space for myself to kind of remember an alternative and so on. And so I guess the impetus behind it was a political one for me in that sense. And yet I didn't think as I was writing them that I was writing a political book. I mean, there are many events in the story that are familiar to us, the invasion of Iraq, events in Palestine, Lebanon, and so on. But at the end, I feel that my emphasis is on the personal, the quotidian, the things that get left out of what we see in the media and so on. Because, I mean, everybody, yes, of course, things in the Middle East can be very intense and the political seems to override everything else. But nonetheless, people in the region continue to live, you know, they continue to fall in love, continue to go through various crises, you know, personal crises, let's say, continue to experience exactly the kinds of things people everywhere in the world do. And it felt, strangely, it felt more urgent for me to kind of consider those questions and then incidentally link them, or they were inevitably, I guess, linked to the bigger political issues that do come up. So in the end, yes, I think in many ways it is a political book. It has to be and deals with a lot of political things. But I, at the same time, more than that, I think it's engaging the smaller things or the things that get overlooked generally.
Yeah, no, that's how it feels. And in terms of audience, have you had an audience in Kuwait? Have you given readings in Kuwait? It's going to be translated into Arabic, do you think?
Yes, okay. Yes. Yeah, there we go.
And then how do you see the world, you know, the potential, when did the audience figure in your mind?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Because, I mean, I find I try to block them out for the writing and consider them a bit more for the rewriting to make sure I haven't done anything particularly irresponsible that might be picked up in a different way. Particularly, I think the sensitivity is greater if you're writing in English about a misunderstood part of the world, that you have a greater onus.
That's a very good question. And as I was writing them, like as you said, you know, at the very beginning, I wasn't thinking about audience at all. Very selfishly, I was just thinking of myself. And it was, as the stories kind of, maybe the fourth or fifth story, I slowly allowed myself to think. I think in some ways thinking of an audience in advance is kind of paralyzing. So I felt like I didn't need to or want to think about that until, as I said, maybe by about the third or fourth story, I allowed myself to think of a very limited audience, which were the kids who grew up, who were around my age, went to those international schools, some of whom, you know, I would talk to and say, do you remember, am I hallucinating, did this exist, did this actually happen? And they'd be like, yes, you know, it did happen, and this Kuwait did exist, and or a version of it anyway. And I allowed myself to kind of think, okay, this can be for them. Writing in English, but then, of course, it expands beyond. You hope and you think, then you allow yourself to imagine an audience that goes beyond that. But that small audience kind of kept me going through the process. In terms of writing in English, I don't know if you asked me this, but in terms of writing in English, because that kind of ties into the question of audience. So as an Arab writer living in the Middle East, writing in English, the question of audience does come up, because then who exactly is your audience? Are they, you know, is it only going to be Western readers or a very limited number of readers in the Middle East? And that is something one has to consider, and I did consider it. But again, for personal and historical contingencies, I didn't have a choice. I had to write it in English, and then hopefully things like translation can alleviate the problem of a limited audience or English restricting an audience. But I think writing in English sort of reflects the reality of many who live in the Middle East, who live this kind of hybrid in-between existence. And I think English, or French for that matter, reflects that reality. And I think that I'm very interested in this kind of new Arabic or Arab literature that's emerging in these languages, which were there, of course, because of a colonial history and remain there because of a kind of a globalized present. So English is an important language, and it's a language that is familiar and spoken by many in the region. And there are many writers that are emerging from the Middle East, not living in the UK or the US or Australia, that are choosing to write in English for reasons like mine or other reasons also. So I find that that's interesting, and it's going to be interesting what kind of audience is generated out of that body of writing. And it's also interesting how that body of writing may or may not affect Arabic literature as well. You know, if Arabic, you know, Arab writers who write in Arabic are aware and are interested in that literature.
Well, I mean, they say that about Darwish, that he brought in so many other European and Western writers,
yes,
and poets into the Arabic language,
yes,
through his poetry, so
absolutely,
it can happen through other media.
Absolutely.
And do you see, I mean, I've seen films here by Kuwaiti filmmakers, young Kuwaiti,
yeah,
filmmakers. Do you feel that there's a bit more of a growing movement of artists and writers in Kuwait? And do you feel that some of them are more sort of politically ambitious and pushing back the boundaries and having a voice which is being heard? Do you feel that there's a growing space for writers and artists to work and to challenge on political subject matter?
I really do. I think that there is a kind of emerging cultural scene in Kuwait. I mean, Kuwait has always been quite vibrant culturally, both in terms of visual art, but also in terms of literature too. But I do see that there seems to me to be a development in that, and especially in film. There's a lot of productivity of young Kuwaiti filmmakers, and I do think that they engage political and social questions in different ways, and I think they're doing that in a very constructive, mm-hmm, and interesting way. So I do see that happening, not just in Kuwait. I think it's happening all over the Gulf.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be a kind of energy and an interesting, and that may have to do with the fact that There's so much coming into the Gulf, mm-hmm, as well, and there's so much movement of people from the Gulf going elsewhere as well. Mm-hmm. So there's this, all of that is happening, and it's generating a lot of interesting cultural production.
Yeah. And is there more of, as time passes, you always feel that people get sort of wise with the event? I mean, is there more of a retrospective looking at, you know, this shift between the world that you described to the post-Gulf War world and what happened, you know, during the Gulf,
yep,
War, and, you know, the changes that took place, because a lot,
yes,
of people were very deeply affected by that. I mean,
yes,
how much of a growing awareness is there of that?
I think two things. One, so it's taken a long time, so that the biggest issue or the biggest transformation for me, but in general, I think, apart from the things that happened to Kuwait, and the devastation that happened as a result of the invasion, was the expulsion of the Palestinian community from Kuwait, which was such a key component of the development of Kuwait as a modern nation, but in terms of education, in terms of culture, and it was such an integral part of the Kuwaiti community, or the community in Kuwait. Unfortunately, not Kuwaiti, and that was one of the mistakes. But that, and then there was the sense of not acknowledging what happened. Mm-hmm. And that, I feel, is changing. So, mm-hmm, in the last 20 years, now people are looking back and thinking maybe this was a mistake, or maybe something. It's just beginning to change. I really, in the last 5 years,
right,
because this is something that I also work on,
yeah,
in my academic work.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I wrote about this in the, let's say, mid to kind of late 90s, it was just out of,
yeah,
bounds, you know, nobody was, and now it was just not something that you could do. And still, there are still issues, and there's still resistance, and it's still problematic sometimes when it comes up, but I definitely am noticing a shift in that, and a recognition that something happened. There's also a kind of, maybe nostalgic,
mm-hmm,
look back at what is. And I see this not only in Kuwait, but also in Lebanon and other places, at a certain Egypt, a golden moment in Kuwait. And I've noticed that a lot of young people, architects, for example, urban historians, others, looking back at a certain time in Kuwait and kind of rethinking some of the decisions that were made and what happened, where did we go wrong, kind of the period of Kuwait's, you know, modernity and development, and saying, why did we go so off track? And those questions weren't being asked before. And I do feel that that is something that's coming up more. Yeah.
Well, I see your work as being part of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.